I am Lo. With an above top secret.com podcast and the issue of the CDC's proposed rules for its ability to quarantine, part two.
We probably have time for two more questions. Next question, please.
Thank you. Anita Manning with USA Today. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you very much for taking this question. I just wonder if you could walk us through an example of a person on an airplane who has a fever or is coughing. I mean, I don't understand how the pilot is going to know that. I guess it would be, so the first line of defense would be flight attendants, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, in reality, what happens is, and this is why, again, most of the reporting, when left to totally passive nature, occurs much after the fact, that a lot of people, against advice of public health recommendations, really will travel while ill, and a smaller number will develop their acute illness, you know, in the course of their journey. But a lot of folks will try to, really motivated to get home or get where they're going, and will do the best to plug on, and may travel while they're ill. For an illness to really reach the awareness and notification of flight attendants and other people who are clearly focused on other job, more appropriately focused on other job responsibilities, it has to be quite evident and quite apparent. Someone whose illness often requires medical assistance or intervention in flight, or some degree of response on the part of a flight attendant. And it may be that individual actually asks for assistance with regard to their illness while they're traveling. That may or may not result in the request that people hear occasionally while they are flying, whether there's a physician on board a flight that can help in an assessment of somebody who's quite ill. And what we're looking for is in the subset of occasions where that type of illness not only rings the attention of a flight attendant, but is also likely to be of a communicable nature and meet these definitions of an ill passenger, where the illness is likely to be an infectious disease and one that may be contagious, to get that notification into the public health officials. We have tried to enhance the ability to notify and detect by developing short cards. Sometimes they're cockpit briefing cards with a list of the major signs and symptoms to be on alert for. Also, enhancing the ability through airlines and other conveyances through their medical departments to educate broadly across the staff of what kinds of things to look for. And then, of course, the concerns are much greater in times of significant global public health emergencies or threats, like SARS, where we move into and are ramped up into a different state of awareness. And really, it's in these settings in particular that we need to be much more complete in our surveillance and assessments in catching such cases.
We'll take two more questions. Next question, please.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Stephen Russell. It's the San Francisco Chronicle.
One other point on the website. If you could repeat those last numbers very slowly before we hang up, that would be very helpful. The question I have, I don't know if it goes under the jurisdiction of the CDC, but I'm wondering about sort of the legal liability questions for a false alarm where somebody either misses a flight or misses a convention or has a vacation, and that these are real practical things that can happen when people are quarantined for a cough that's just a cough. And I'm just wondering if these regulations in any way address that kind of sort of practical issue of what happens when someone is quarantined for no good reason.
Well, I would hope that never occurs, that people aren't quarantined for no good reason. As I mentioned earlier in my remarks, there are only 9 specific diseases specified by presidential executive order for which the legal authority of legal federal authority can be used to quarantine individuals, to quarantine people. And I'm happy to recite them, but I can also point you to our website where you can find them. There were 7 until recently in 2003 when SARS was added to that list, and in April of 2005 when pandemic strains of influenza were added to that list. So the threshold for diseases for which a quarantine order would be issued is really quite high. Cholera, yellow fever, plague, smallpox, infectious tuberculosis, diphtheria, and then you know, SARS and viral hemorrhagic fevers and influenza. So we're talking about, you know, things like Ebola virus and people who are really quite ill and are spontaneously hemorrhaging from multiple body sites. These are not always subtle conditions that would really raise people's awareness and attention. And we're not talking about, you know, quarantining anybody for a sniffle or a cough alone. That's really not going to be, you know, the case, and it has not occurred. I do think that there are lots of things specified in these regulations which do allow for due process and sort of balance of individual civil liberties against public good, and for these things not to be applied in a capricious or whimsical manner and not to be applied in a discriminatory way, but to be applied even-handedly across all persons. And I'm hoping that the safeguards as well as the requirements for the disease threshold to be quite significant that would get us away from the kinds of situations that you are in. And I would also point out that there are a whole other set of, outside of the CDC arena, a whole other set of way to handling passengers who are inadvertently, for whatever reason, you know, detained from their ability to make their connections as, you know, as is reasonable, that have been worked out through the industry at times, whether that be weather or all sorts of other things. So it's not like there isn't precedent for those kinds of adjustments to be made by reasonable people.
Our final question, please.
Thank you. Bob Ross with SIDRAP News, your line is now open.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the challenges that the CDC encountered during the SARS episode, how much you had to use isolation and quarantine, and what kinds of problems occurred then.
That's a great question, and I think it's very germane because, as many know, it really was the global SARS epidemic in 2003 that highlighted our global gaps as well as our global strengths and abilities to respond to these threats. From a specific focus of these regulations, one of the things we realized is the absence of rapid electronic passenger manifests with detailed contact information to find individuals completely paralyzed our ability to notify people who were on board together with suspect SARS cases during this epidemic in a timely way, that is within the incubation period of 2 weeks of that illness. And that was really, really quite shocking. On an individual basis, it is challenging enough for a single ill person with a significant public health disease and a plane load of folks around them for that information to be achieved and notification to occur in a timely way to get somebody, you know, post-exposure prevention for meningococcal meningitis, for example, or even for measles situations and other things. So filling the gap in inadequacies in contact tracing is a very important one to plug, and it was a leading recommendation of the after-action GAO report to the Secretary of Health as well as the Secretary of State and Transportation in addressing. Now, there were other issues around SARS, which was that globally where there was a tremendous amount of community transmission and intense burden of the epidemic in several Asian countries and in Toronto, voluntary isolation and quarantine orders, and in many cases compulsory orders for isolation and quarantine, were used and were an important component of effectively stamping out that epidemic and sort of putting the genie back in the bottle. In the United States, where the impact of this disease was minimized, we had a policy of rapid isolation of suspect cases that had a compatible case definition for SARS as defined by the World Health Organization, which was the illness profile in conjunction with an epidemiologic link with a transmission area. And we very much used rapid detection and rapid isolation along with heightened surveillance through passenger notifications. During this period, CDC staff were present at 25 points of entry, meeting every flight arriving from an impacted area directly or one stop indirectly, and handing out yellow notification cards in what symptoms to look for and how to rapidly respond to the emergence of those symptoms over the incubation period of SARS. So the general policy was early detection, rapid isolation, and containment. And we did not have a federal policy of using quarantine of contact as part of our containment strategy at the federal level during the SARS epidemic in 2003. I will say that many states, however, when faced with high-risk situations, healthcare workers exposed to unsuspecting laboratory-confirmed SARS cases in emergency rooms where aerosol-producing procedures were going on and there were lots of people at risk, did recommend that those immediately exposed healthcare workers not come to work and stay home voluntarily during the period of incubation and monitor themselves for symptoms and onset of SARS symptoms and self-exclude. So during SARS in 2003, worldwide, largely voluntary isolation and quarantine, home quarantine, was a principal strategy used to contain this epidemic. And in some areas, compulsory quarantines as well as fever monitoring and other approaches were used. And these are important tools that we need to keep in our toolbox and not forget that really our history of having direct medical countermeasures is quite short in the last 5 decades or so, in contrast with centuries of public health practice in which non-pharmaceutical countermeasures were used to contain communicable diseases. With that, I'd like to wrap up that, you know, these proposed changes are just one component of CDC and HHS's strategy to better prepare us for the globalization of communicable disease threats. They're necessary to expedite and improve our operations. They facilitate contact tracing. They provide immediate medical follow-up of infected passengers and contacts. And they streamline the streamlining of this procedure will enhance and benefit the American public by reducing deaths and illnesses and avoiding unnecessary quarantines and unnecessary delays by detecting outbreaks and responding to them early. I think that there are many other things going on to enhance our country's preparedness to combat these threats, both in the isolation and quarantine arena and the community control and the international controls, as well as in the preparation of stockpiles and direct medical countermeasures that are available for the significant threats that are on our horizon. In addition, the international health regulations were just passed by the World Health Assembly in May of 2005, and in many ways provide an analogous global framework for containment of these types of threats as well. This notice that is released today is a notice of proposed rulemaking to combat and to plug the gap that we've identified in this arena. We look forward to public comment and comment of stakeholders and constituents that may be impacted by this proposal in a way to enhance and improve upon it before issuance of a final rule, which will take place following the receipt and incorporation and of public comment. So with that, I'd like to close and thank everybody very much for getting together on short notice to communicate this message.
Thanks, Marty. Let me repeat the website where the regs are posted and apologize again. We thought that we initially thought they would be available immediately at the Federal Register, and they'll pop up, I believe, later this week, Wednesday, tomorrow. But today they're available at www.cdc.gov/NCIDOD/DQ, Division of Quarantine. If anyone has any questions, please don't hesitate to call the press office, and we'll get back in touch. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. This does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation.